This interview is being conducted by Nancy Perozzo with the assistance of Tori Tronrud of the museum. And it is October 7th, 2015, and it's being conducted at the museum. So now I'll ask the fellow that we're interviewing to introduce himself and his connection to the grain trade. And I can just leave this here. So anytime you want to start.
Okay, my name is Don Arril, A-R-R-I-L. I worked at Woodside Brothers as a machinist apprentice from 1951 to 1955, during which time they manufactured various components for grain elevators, including the grain sampler that we have here.
Right. And I think before I forget, I'd like to just have you comment on this item. I'm going to turn it on, and maybe you can tell us, well, how would that compare in size to...
Oh.
Just let me... Well, I think maybe that'll interfere with our... Yeah. So would that compare in size?
This belt would be probably 4 feet wide.
Okay.
And this machine would... Like I said, I've never seen one in operation, but they would stand probably about my height, about 5 foot 7, approximately.
And what are the other components of it?
Well, this belt would... a lot longer, and as they were moving the grain from the bins to the elevator or the elevator to the bins, this belt would be loaded with grain. And originally they had to take samples of this grain as it moved along the belt. They would have a man had a stick with a little cup on it, and he would stand there and take scoops of grain. This was an automatic sampler. When it was running, the grain would be...
Do you want me to turn it on?
Yeah. The grain would be running this way. And as it passed under, these small aluminum cups would pick up small amounts of grain, dump them in this hopper, they'd go down the pipe and into the container, which I believe was a metal basket. And that way they eliminated having a man standing there
and
picking samples.
Am I correct in thinking that the sampler could also deliver it to the sampling area of the elevator, or did it just go into a bucket?
It just went into a bucket, and I believe somebody collected it every now and then. Like I say, I've never seen the actual operation, so...
And what did Woodside make all of the parts of it?
We had a foundry where all these sprockets would be made of cast iron, which they poured right in the foundry. The frame was made of angle iron. The chain we purchased from a manufacturer, it wasn't quite like this. It was not quite as nice as that, but it'd come in big rolls and you just hooked it together whatever length you wanted.
And they would make this. What is this thing called here?
That's the hopper.
The hopper, okay.
Yeah. And it would dump little, at random as it went along the belt, it would dump little amounts of grain in here into a bucket, which would be taken away and sampled periodically.
And did they make the buckets as well? Do you recall?
These buckets, no, they bought them pre-made because it was cheaper than making. We could have made them, but it's cheaper to buy them. But the rest of the sprockets and all the framework was made at Woodside's.
Tori, you have some questions.
When did they make these?
Well, I worked there in the 50s, and they had actually installed some in Winnipeg prior to my being there. Some of the guys from the shop went out to an elevator in Winnipeg and installed them. I don't really know the time frame.
So they were still making them when you left?
Yeah.
So Woodside did business in Winnipeg. It was my understanding from the person who donated this little working model that they had salesmen that went around the country or the world marketing this automatic grain sampler. Is that... Anything you're familiar with?
I'm not aware of that, no.
No?
They made other equipment for elevators. They made what they called an oat huller, which was like a big round cast iron drum with a pan in it. And the oats went in the end and it agitated them viciously in there and knocked the other hull off the oats. And we made parts for the car dumpers and the cleaners, the brushes that used to sweep over the screens. We made brush hubs and arms, and quite a few products for the elevators.
Who was responsible for designing it, do you know?
I think Art Woodside himself, as far as I know, designed this.
What can you tell us about the whole Woodside operation? Maybe I'll have you just come and sit back here so that we can be sure that you're close to the...
Clumsy, sorry.
No, this was sticking out. This was sticking out and it's gray, so you can't really see it. Okay. So normally how we begin these interviews is we ask how you got involved in the first place. So I should just sort of step back and ask that question.
Well,
so
I wanted to learn a trade, so I quit school at 16 and went to Woodside's.
And why did you pick them?
They needed an apprentice.
Did you know anyone there? Did your dad say, oh, go down there, they're looking for somebody?
No, my dad had worked there in the 20s for a short period, but he didn't stick with it.
Ah.
He thought it would be a good job for me.
Where did your family come from?
My father comes from Scotland. My mother was born here, but her family came from Sweden.
And did your dad have a trade when he came over?
No, he was 8 years old.
Oh, just and a young guy.
He worked on the railroad for a while, and then he became a city fireman for 40 years in Port Arthur.
And so when you started Woodside, was he still a fireman?
Mm-hmm.
So he would have been involved with fighting the fires, the elevator fires then in 45?
Yes, he was.
Did he ever speak about that?
Yeah, and he didn't like to, because he witnessed some not very nice scenes there. People burned and it bothered him quite a bit. So he didn't say too much about it.
Yeah, had he, I'm just going to take this over here. Had your dad been in the war?
No.
No?
No.
So he hadn't had the experience of having to deal with people in really rough shape?
Well, just at fires, yes.
Yeah.
And car accidents.
Yeah. I imagine it was pretty traumatic.
Yeah, he was pretty broken up when he came home that day.
I imagine he might even have known some of the people because...
Possibly, I don't
small,
know.
You know, the cities weren't that big.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you went to... tell me where Woodside's was. What did the operation look like when you went?
It was a wooden building, and on the side it said Port Arthur Iron Works. I believe that had been their original name, run by his father and his father's brother. And then when they retired or passed away, Art Woodside took over.
And any idea how old Art was at the time you started?
I think he was 68. I remember that number when I was working there.
So the family had been here a long time?
Oh, yeah. The shop began operation in 1883, I believe. And it was torn down in the 90s. Around that time.
It was an old building then,
yeah.
By the time you started.
Yeah, well, it had burnt down at least once and been rebuilt, but I don't know how old the building was I worked in. But
yeah. Can you recall, I know you've got a good memory and you like old buildings. We were talking about that before because you do some work now at the Pioneer Village. Are you able to describe what it was like if I asked you, you know, if you walked in the door, you know, wherever you walked in, what would you see?
Inside there was a double door about probably 5 or 6 feet wide. And to the right, just inside the door, was a small office. And behind that, there was a stairway going upstairs where they built sawmills. The sawmills were built in the upstairs part. And all the cast iron parts were made in the machine shop. And past the office, there was an erection area, and there was a big planer, and six or seven lathes and shapers, all sorts of machine shop equipment, all run by one motor and line shafts and belts and pulleys.
Would rope pulleys, I assume, initially?
No,
or?
No, these were flat leather belts.
Ah.
And to the back of the shop, there was a door that opened into the foundry where they made cast iron and brass castings. And on the right side at the back was a fairly large blacksmith shop. And there were several warehouses outside, storage places.
How many people were working there?
Oh, I think when I was there, there was probably about 14 or 15. I think they had as many as 25 at times. And they worked for not just the grain elevators, they worked for all different industries and sawmills.
Paper mills were still going?
They did some paper mill work, yes.
When you first got on the job, that first day that you were hired and walked onto the job, what did they have you doing?
Sweeping the floor.
So you said you were an apprentice?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of training did you get, I would say?
You helped the tradesmen, the journeymen, on the bigger machine shop jobs, and we worked outside. We did some repair work in the elevators and on the lake boats and tugs, and I was usually the helper on that job, and the truck driver. And then I got more experience in the machine shop and eventually became a machinist.
So what does a machinist do?
He makes parts. Like if you wanted one of these made, we would take a piece of rough steel, put it in the lathe, machine it down and make it look like that. Or gears, or bushings, or bearings, any of the parts on there except the chain we would make from a piece of just round steel bar or whatever.
Did you enjoy the work?
Yeah, I did.
What was your favorite part?
I think going out on the jobs to the elevators and the lake boats, I enjoyed that.
What was it about those projects that you liked?
Just getting to see something I'd never seen before. Got a few short rides on the lake boats from one elevator to the other. And it was interesting.
Now, I'm not that familiar with the what would have been the Port Arthur waterfront. But the Woodside operation, which was the closest elevator to that?
Pool 6.
Okay.
People at Pool 6 went by Woodside's on Manitou Street, turned right at Oscar Stips and went to Pool 6.
Can you recall the first time you went inside a grain elevator?
No, I guess. We worked in quite a few of them.
So what would be the kinds of things you would do when you went in the elevators?
We installed we made another machine there. It was called a car door opener for opening the grain doors in the cars, and we installed some of those. That was another Woodside invention, I believe. They had a patent on some of the parts anyway. And we had to go up over the car in the top of the car sheds and cut keyways in the shaft and install the drums up there to operate the car door openers.
It was a hard physical job then, I would say.
It was cold and windy up there because it was usually winter time.
Right, they were shut down for maintenance.
Yeah, and I used to go home all itchy and scratchy. But it was interesting.
Yeah. Did you get to go to the top of the elevator, to the other
No.
level? So your work was done
all in the bottom.
On the
did other jobs at Empire and Thunder Bay Elevator. I just can't remember what we did there, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a variety of ways of emptying a boxcar.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen film of the boxcar, the whole boxcar being tilted mm-hmm. and emptied. How did the door opener work?
I would have to give you a bit of a demonstration. Can I use this? Originally, a lot of the elevators.
Why don't you, just because, so that we have this on tape, why don't you use, let me just pause this for the time being, and we'll find something for you to use so that I can photograph you doing this, okay?
Okay.
When they pulled the boxcar in, they had what they called a car haul. There were different methods. And inside the boxcar door, there was horizontal boards in there that held the grain in the car, and they blew it in through the top. Those doors had to be removed. And the original system, they had a ram. As they pulled the car in, they would dig this ram into the door, which would slide these boards up on top of the grain. But sometimes they missed and they hit the side of the boxcar. Well, that didn't stop it. It would go through the boxcar. So the machine that Woodside made, the car was stationary and the ram was put in and there was no chance of putting it through the side of the car. Okay. And we installed that, I can't remember what elevator, Green Growers for one and 4 or 4B, I can't remember. We did several of them.
And it was effective?
Yeah. There was this ram, there was a piece of angle there like this, and there was a winch that just pulled it up and just slid the doors up on top of the grain, and then they had the shovels to. And some of them pulled six, and the grain growers, they had the car dumpers that you were describing.
Yeah.
And they would tip the car both ways. And we made a lot of shafting and parts, big parts for them.
And it was Art Woodside that was the genius behind these inventions?
He must have been quite a person, I would think.
He was a nice man to work for.
What did you like about him? What made him a good man to work for?
Oh, he was considerate. If you had a problem, you go and talk to Mr. Woodside and he'd help you straighten it out. Everybody liked him.
Very approachable.
Yeah, he was.
But he could, I guess what amazes me about a lot of these people, and he seems to be one of them, is like some people would see a problem, like smashing the door, or not just the door, the boxcar as well, and just say, oh well, and leave it at that. But he had that talent of seeing a problem and wanting to fix it.
Yeah. And they also made sawmills for the local woodlot owners. When I left in 55, they were working on, I think, number 840-something, so they made a lot of them. He didn't design the sawmill. There was a chap by the name of Oliver Smedberg who designed these, and he used to come to Woodside's to buy parts. And he was coming in there time after time buying parts and building these sawmills, so they had the whole upstairs vacant in the shop, so they got him to come in there and build them there. Everything was done in one place.
You said you also got on the ships. What kind of work would you be doing on that?
Small maintenance jobs, fixing pumps and removing broken bolts, all different sorts of things.
So they had a sort of a maintenance operation as well as a manufacturing operation?
Yeah. And we had equipment for reboring steam engines on the tugs. And we worked all one winter on the tug Rogers at Canada Dredge. The low pressure cylinder, I believe, was 42 inches or something, the cylinder. And we had a portable boring machine that you set up in there and you machined the inside of this sleeve. It took days and days to do it. And then we cast a new piston in the shop and made piston rings. So it was a good winter's work.
Was it a really hopping place at that time, between when you were there, did you say 51 to 55?
At times. Yeah. At times we worked a lot of overtime, and other times it was quiet.
Now they would have had, actually I was just looking at some files, and they had a 1952 explosion in the elevator, so you would have been on the waterfront there mm-hmm. yourself. And then there was 1956 at Pool 6.
I'm not aware of that one.
Yeah.
There was two of them at, well, there's Pool 4, what was it, Pool 4 and Pool 4B or
yes.
something?
Yes, yeah,
and
A and B.
And I think they both had their, or was there two explosions? There was one in the 40s.
45.
Yeah, that's the one my dad was at. Mm-hmm. And then there was one in the 50s, because I was working at Woodside's when that happened. And
were you actually there?
No.
And but they did some rebuilding too. So was Woodside's involved at all in?
No, that would be bigger contractors.
Oh, okay. And where would the bigger contractors come from?
Oh, I don't know really. I was just in my teens, and I wasn't much interested in that.
Did Woodside have any competition?
Well, there was Dingwalls and Northern Engineering, put out the shipyard, and they were all pretty busy. Cross, Ernie Cross had a machine shop.
So did Woodside's pay well?
Not me. I was working on construction, and I went from $1.05 an hour to a 50 cents an hour at Woodside. But I learned to trade too, so.
So where did your career take you after that?
December 55, I went to Red Rock, which was St. Lawrence Corporation in those days, and as a machinist, millwright they called me. And I worked there for 13 years. I went to Ontario Hydro at Cameron Falls for almost 25 years, and then I retired.
And how did you follow the fortunes of Woodside Company? What happened to them?
They downsized somewhat. Art Woodside retired, and he moved to, I think, Madison or Red Lake, who lived with his daughter. And Woodside's downsized somewhat, and eventually, I'm not sure, in the 90s or 80s, I guess they closed down. Eventually tore the building down.
What's there now?
Nothing, I don't think.
Is it part of the Prince Arthur?
It's part of that whole development area, but well, they haven't worked at it yet.
I don't know the details, but apparently it was land that was leased from the railroad where the shop was. They had a 99-year lease, or I don't know the details, but and I think the railroad wanted it back.
Because you said it was close to Pool 6, right?
Yeah.
So and they probably owned that land heading from the railway to the elevator.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
The shop was right beside the tracks, and it was just a short block from Cumberland Street behind, what number? I forget, there was a lumber company, Laskin Store, and the lumber company on that corner, and Woodside's were just across the tracks from the lumber company.
Would that have been Pigeon River? Or am I in the wrong place?
In the early days, probably, yes. But at this time, I'm not sure.
I can't remember.
So where would Woodside's get their supplies from? We were talking about coal earlier.
Yeah, I don't know where they got that. The foundry where they made the iron castings, they used coke. And they would buy that from someplace by the carload. It was much cheaper. And about every couple of years, they'd get a boxcar full of coke and unload it into the shed behind the shop.
And what else? I'm not very...
Steel and...
Yeah,
and
where would
steel
this...
And that, most of it come from Marshall Wells and Cochran Hardware, local hardware retailer dealers.
come up from the States mostly, would you think?
Most of it we got locally. And they did order like big steel shafting. I don't know where they got that from. But,
any connection with iron ore? That's too far, that's too early on in the chain.
No, they didn't. I mean, they were shipping iron ore out from the Second World War on, but they weren't doing much smelting of it here.
Before my time, they did make a lot of mining equipment. And you have pictures of it over here, the tram cars and wheels and everything with it. There was nothing like that when I was there.
You see lots of manhole covers still in the cities. Oh, yeah,
pretty steady.
So were you involved in the actual smelting part and the foundry part?
Yeah, well, they poured iron about once a week. And I didn't work in the foundry, but all the apprentices on iron pouring day, that's where you landed up. You had to go and help in the foundry. Everybody who was available had to work on that.
We have a number of wooden forms.
Patterns.
Patterns, yes. Now, can you explain the process of how those would have been used?
Well, a casting, an iron casting, this shape, you would make a wooden pattern. So we usually made of white pine, and it would be split in half.
Right.
And they would put it upside down on a piece of flat board with a box around it, pack sand in it, and then turn it over and take that pattern out, and there'd be an indentation. They do the same with the other side, and put the two molds together, and two holes come up, one for the iron to go in, another one for the air to come out, and basically that was it. The patterns usually had to be in two pieces to get the mold apart to take the pattern out.
And you pour it inside and...
Yeah.
So is the mold just, you said you had molds that were wood.
Yeah.
The wood wouldn't burn?
Just, the wood is the pattern.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You pack sand all around it, and then you take the pattern out and it leaves the hole, the size and shape of the pattern. And the wooden pattern had to be a little bit bigger than the piece you wanted because if you pour 2 foot long piece of iron, it'll shrink a quarter of an inch. I think an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch to the foot shrinkage. So the pattern always had to be bigger than the finished product.
Precise measuring then.
Some of the castings were quite intricate. And I think the biggest ones we made were around 1,800 pounds. A piece of iron, We made a big car hall drum for, I think, Pool 6 elevator. And if I remember right, it came in around 1,800 pounds.
Were they... Now, I've seen some pictures of elevator construction around the time you were working, and they were still using horses for delivering. When they got these big pieces you were talking about, how were they delivered?
By truck,
So a modern operation.
Yeah. And we had a hand-operated crane in front of the shop for loading and unloading stuff. That was the apprentice's job, to crank the crane to load and unload parts as they come in.
Now I saw the chimney, the great big chimney for the powerhouse at the Fort William elevator, which was built in 1913. What would it be, the clean out door?
At the bottom?
Big, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it would be, yeah.
So Woodside made that one there.
Did they?
Yep, their name was on it.
Yeah.
So how would they do that? Like how a lot of these, it was almost ornate.
Yeah.
So how did they get
the pattern
name on it?
It would be made of wood, and they'd make wooden numbers and fasten them on. And then when they took the pattern out, the indentation of the letters and the numbers would be there and the iron would flow into them.
So did they have like an artist on staff who was,
no,
you know,
they
because
had
they're the, quite,
no, they had
quite the, lovely.
What they called a pattern maker. He made all the patterns.
Do you remember what the fellow's name was when you were there?
The pattern maker was Jack Toole. And there were probably three molders, they called them, the men that set these sand molds up. There was a Harry Gibson, I remember. He was an older man. He was about the same age as Art Woodside. And Ed Fawcett, I guess they were the two main ones when I was there.
Who took over for Mr. Woodside when he retired?
When Art Woodside retired, his nephew, Bob Newsom, who also was a foreman for Art, and the other foreman, Stuart Baird, they bought the shop from Art Woodside. They operated until, well, Stuart passed away, I can't remember when, and Bob Newsom operated until it closed.
Did they operate it under Woodside name? Continued with the name?
Yeah, it was
as far
still.
As you
know? He changed the name a little bit to Woodside Machinist and Foundry Company, but it was still under the Woodside name.
You were talking earlier about the foundry? That was a nice, cool place, right?
Well, not when they were pouring iron. It was a very hot place. The foundry had a sand floor because that was, you used the sand to make the molds, and once the castings were done, as the castings hardened, you took them out of the boxes, and the sand went back on the floor and was used over and over again.
Did people have trouble with that heat? I was thinking it's like an enclosed blacksmith shop.
No, was it was just hot. Usually one day a week. Of course, really busy, maybe 2 days a week, but you would start probably around noon, it would start getting hot in there. But you were through by 4 o'clock usually.
Was it a dangerous place to work or not so?
Not by the standards then, I don't think so. We had one serious injury, a man got burnt, but on average I'd say it was comparable to any other industry. And, they also made brass and aluminum castings, but iron was the main one. We made brass bushings and bearings, boat propellers, all different things.
So how would they get the specs for boat propellers?
Usually take it from the original one. You'd have a propeller come in with the blade broken off it. And they would take the measurements off that. And I'm guessing at that, I don't really know.
How do they attach a broken piece?
Well, we used to usually make a new one.
I guess a whole new propeller?
Yeah. I guess they could have been welded on, but it's not too good a job. We made none very big, I think up to a couple of feet maybe in diameter. Can't think of anything else right now.
No.
So you must have worked some pretty odd hours. I mean, the elevators tended to work round the clock. Were you sort of on call? If things went wrong suddenly?
Well, we normally worked, I think we worked a 48-hour week when I went there. We worked 9 hours a day and then half a day Saturday. And when things got busy, we worked weekends and nights. And
right. So you'd wait for the call then, if need to be.
Yeah. And sometimes the boats would come in to one of the elevators and we'd have some small repair work to do on it. We'd go right on the boat and fix the pump or whatever needed fixing.
Were you, as you look back on it now, those 5 years, Are you glad you had those 5 years?
Yes. Yes. You give me a trade that kept me going all my life. And after I retired, I still do that at Founders. And I had a little shop in my basement before I moved to town.
What did you do in the basement?
Oh, I made parts for, I collect old engines, antique engines. I made most of my own parts. I made a complete engine one time, a little model gasoline engine that runs. So it keeps me busy.
Somebody once said that someone in town had built a model elevator, a model working elevator. That's not ever anything you've heard about.
No.
Somewhere, someplace, there's...
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Mm-hmm. A lot of work, mm-hmm. even just, you know, for an engine.
Yeah.
And what are you doing at the Founders? What are they up to there?
I went there to help them get their old tractors and engines running, and we do a little bit of everything, building maintenance. And I told you a while back there, somebody donated a couple of tons of coal. Rather than have it go to the dump, we hauled that to Founders and stored it in the corner. We got enough to keep our blacksmith shop going for 100 years.
As long as there's some people around who know the trade that you know.
Yeah, well, there's a few blacksmiths around. It's actually a trade that's coming back. People are learning blacksmithing and shoeing horses, and for a while there was nobody to do that.
So when you think back on that time at Woodsides, and I'm amazed that you can even think back on that time with such clarity, what were you most proud of?
I can't really say. I think I enjoyed working on the boats. To me, they're so big and huge engines and everything. I got quite a kick out of that.
It was good to work with. I imagine you worked with the engineers or the on the boats.
Yeah, the chief engineer would show us what he wanted done, and some of them were regular customers. The journeymen that I worked with all knew him, so we had a good relationship with them.
Anything else, Torrid? Now, I'm going to ask you this question, and you may have an answer, you may not, but the reason that we interviewed you is because we feel that your work is a part of the grain industry. So here's my question. Canada, in spite of its geography and its climate, has become one of the world's greatest grain traders.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that the work that you did and the work that the Foundry or the Woodsides did contributed to Canada being successful?
Well, I would say it's a small part, but they helped keep the machines running, and they designed some equipment that nobody else made at that time anyway.
Leaders.
I think they made a small contribution to the success of the industry.
I agree. Well, thank you very much.
I'm... See, now I live in an apartment in Current River and I supervise all the boats out in the harbor.
You've noticed a few of them hanging around, have you?
Yes. Yeah. I often wonder about that. Some of the salties sit there for a week or two.
Yeah.
And must lose a lot of money.
Yes, they're waiting for a shipment.
Yeah. Somebody's paying, because they don't sit there with the crew without the costs going up quite quickly. So thank you very much.
Oh, well,
I enjoyed the interview.
I'm sure you'll edit some of that out.
No.